and sing my song. I say, damn, they're cute and sing along.
This is Simon Shaheen. You are listening to WGXC Accra 90.7 FM.
Why did you say that?
Aloha out there in Radio Land.
Hey, this is Andy, host of Crawl Up from the Fallout with Raven Sings the Blues. The show is a monthly roundup of new music, plumbing psych, folk, cosmic Americana, indie, garage, and exploratory titles alongside enough classic gems to hold it all together like glue. You can tune into the show every second Tuesday of the month from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on WGXC 90.7 FM.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Crisafulli Brothers Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, and Electrical, Upstate New York's home services company since 1993. Red Carpet Service and Solutions. For more information, visit CRISBRO.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Food New York in New York, New York. WGXC local business supporters help us continue to be a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement. Thank you, Food New York.
My name is Justin, and you're listening to WGXC Accra 90.7 FM. This is Ginger Radio Hour, live from the Accra studio. Today, my friend, the writer and naturalist Leslie T. Sharp, will be joining us live on the phone from the Great Western Catskills. That's coming up at about 10:25. So that gives us about 20 minutes to set the mood. So let's do that. Here's Still House Plants.
Oh,
That was a bit of a summer solstice preview. Little theme here going. That was Low with the track Half-Light from the Mothman Prophecies soundtrack. And before that, Andre 3000, and we opened it up with Stillhouse Plants. The track there was No Sleep, Deep Risk. Again, Thursday is the summer solstice. Late afternoon, I think it's sometime around 4 p.m. Eastern. And it's the longest day of the year. The most sunlight. The most sun. We'll come back to that theme at the end of today. Now I'm going to play one whole side of an album I just got. It's really terrific. It's Keith Jarrett. And I don't even know how to describe how incredible this album is. So I'm just going to play. We're going to jump in. It's the Württemberg Sonatas. Keith Jarrett is playing these sonatas by the famous Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach. Right? Not the Bach, but the next Bach. Pretty incredible stuff. So I'm going to put this side, side three of this double album, and get Leslie on the phone. I'll see you in about 13 minutes. Thank you. That, of course, was Keith Jarrett playing Sonata 4 in B-flat major of Bach, but the son Bach. That's Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach. Pretty tremendous new album I have. I think on the phone is Leslie T. Sharp. I think I've done all the right things on the board here. Leslie, can you hear me?
You have indeed. I'm here.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining Ginger Radio Hour today.
It's my great pleasure to be with you, as always.
I'd like to give you a bit of a big pomp and circumstance intro here. For those of you that don't know Leslie T. Sharp, she is a writer and a naturalist and a good friend. She's always been a big supporter of me, which I appreciate. And she changed my relationship to the Catskills because I read her book, The Quarry Fox and Other Critters of the Wild Catskills. I think I read it maybe in 2019. It came out in 2017. I highly recommend it. But she's done so much more. She's actually been named one of the 50 stewards of the Catskills by the Catskill Center for Conservation and Development. And you heard her here back in 2022, reading from her essay, The Bluebird Chronicles, A Catskills Romance, which was featured in a collection in the Appalachia Journal. Leslie lives in the great Western Catskills, and so I'm always eager because it's a little bit different over there than where I am here, right off of, right below Windham Mountain. So I always want to know what's happening with Leslie, and especially what's happening in the meadow outside. How are you doing, Leslie?
I am doing very well. And yes, the Great Western Catskills are actually the Catskill foothills, and we are very rural. People that come from the east, the very sophisticated areas of Woodstock, for me, the big city, and Phoenicia, they always say, "My, it's so undeveloped here," and it is undeveloped. Part of it is where I am between two of the great reservoirs, Papacton and Cannonsville, and sometimes people forget or they don't even know that all that good city water comes from the Catskills, and we have several mammoth reservoirs, which also, frankly, serve as preserved land. So, yes, it's pretty wild still, and I'm on the side of a mountain, and I have two wonderful meadows. They're not hay meadows. In other words, they're not planted with alfalfa or timothy. They're not cut down like at the end of the month of May and several other times for fodder for cows and horses. They are wild, wildflower. Meadows. And so I have native grasses that are very tall. And what's interesting is the meadow is so high this year. And it reminds you that here in the Catskills, we live so close to nature and we're very attuned to weather. And last year, I'm sure you will remember and some of your listeners will remember, there was that terrible frost in mid-May. It wasn't just a little frost, it was down into the mid-20s. And like the north-facing sides of trees that were developing new leaves, like my great shagbark hickory tree, were black. And the apple crop was terribly impacted. And that was a climate change thing, that there's less predictability now. And, you know, the idea of being a farmer up here is tough enough because you're so dependent on weather. And not just weather, but the balance. There's an alchemy of sun and rain, you know, and we could use some rain right now. I always go by, I sort of measure it by what's happening with the corn. It's mostly agricultural corn here. And you can see it's, you know, could use a little rain. But earlier this spring, we had good rain and enough sun. And I noticed the meadows were so high, and I love that, higher than usual. And they are such a natural place for all kinds of wildlife. I have my bluebirds are fledged, but I still have my tree swallows in their boxes, and they love the meadows. And one of the reasons why the box is right on the edge of the meadow is because, of course, they're insectivores and they're aerial artists. They're not like the bluebirds that hop down and sort of peck around for grubs and things like that. No, these guys fly. And to see them flying over the meadows, because the meadows are alive with insects. And I just went outside before I called you and threw some old cherries out, thinking, well, let the critters have them, and there's also nice water content in them. With this heat, it's a good thing. And a swallow looked like it was trying to intercept a cherry, and then I looked, because it came back, two of them, and I realized they were barn swallows, not tree swallows. And I said, where have you guys come from? Because I don't really have a barn that's open, and they're not going to go to nest boxes. They like an open area to nest. And then I looked in the upper meadow, and they were hunting over that upper meadow. So the meadow is just really alive with all kinds of insect, which draws the birds. And then, of course, in the spring, one of the first, our first arrivals is the red-winged blackbird, the males. And the first guy who comes always grabs the pond, because that's prime territory for him, in the reeds, in the cattails. They have lovely cattails. And he doesn't let anyone else have it. It's not a big pond. And they can have as many as three nests that are his with his... He's not like, not all birds are like that, but he's polygamous. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to reassure all of our female listeners that research has shown that the eggs in these nests, that Big Red sort of runs with his three girls, as it were, have been shown to not have always his DNA. So there's stuff going on all the time in the animal. His mandate is to get his genes out there. Their mandate is to get the male that they think, well, you know, my guy's okay, but this guy's got better feathers, which is a big thing. So, you know, there's all this stuff going on that science is kind of apprising us of a little bit. So we have the plant life in the meadow. What's exciting to me is my meadow is really becoming a milkweed meadow. And I'm certainly letting it do that. And milkweed, as you know, is so linked to the life cycle of the monarch butterfly, but it's not just the monarch. Of over 400 insect species use milkweed. And a lot of people don't know this, but our beloved hummingbirds that are insectivores as well as nectar feeders. As a matter of fact, they have to have insects to feed their young. Insects are about protein, you know, so it's not just, you know, going to flowers and going to our hummingbird feeders like I have, and I'm sure many of your listeners have, because they're wonderful to watch. And that beautiful, fragrant red milkweed flower, which aren't up yet, but they also attract, you know, hummingbirds. So that's a whole extraordinary ecosystem in itself. Milkweed is really a foundational plant and is considered sort of the food store, you know, of so much insect life.
Leslie, did you do something to ensure that the milkweed would come back or grow at a certain pace, or did it just happen?
It seeded itself. And, of course, these are native milkweeds, which, you know, for folks wanting to plant milkweed, and even if you just want to take a corner of your yard and let it go to wildflowers, that can really draw a lot of creatures. You must be sure you get native, specific to our area, milkweed. One of the problems, it's been hard to sort of get milkweed seeds of native milkweed, very much in demand. I really should go out there at the end of the season and just crack them open and take the seeds and give them to whoever wants them. But what's interesting about that issue is because, you know, originally monarchs have been around for a million years and they come up from Mexico and people think, well, you know, tropical milkweed, which is actually Mexican milkweed, that's where they're from. Isn't that okay? And actually it's not. They are adapted to the milkweeds of our area and wherever else they breed, like in the western regions, to those areas. And if you do tropical milkweed, interestingly, it takes longer to bloom than ours. And what that can do for monarchs is make them not migrate, because they're saying, oh, I'll hang around here, this is blooming. And monarchs have to migrate. They're one of those instincts that can't overwinter. several butterflies, moths like Luna moth, can sort of wrap its little pupae in a leaf and stay hidden all winter. These guys can't. That's why they migrate back. So it's wonderful to grow milkweed and have the monarchs, but be sure you ask for native, not Japanese, not tropical. And it's hard to get that, but it's crucial because another thing about those other milkweeds, because it isn't what they're adapted to, everything is about, talk about adaptation, everything is about adaptation. The actual caterpillar, the actual butterfly, it can be weaker, you know? So everything is on, everything as we know is in balance, and it's the balance that to a great degree we've disrupted, and we're now many, many, many great people are trying to reestablish, and that's an important one. But no, the milkweed took care of itself, and I'm happy with that.
Of course. Have you had any sightings this spring of turtles or bears?
I foolishly left my... I do feed the birds during the day, and I bring in the feeder, and because I love watching them is what it is, but I bring it in. But I didn't take the feeders in early enough. It was March, and I heard a kerfuffle right outside my window where the feeders are, and I looked out. There was a bear, looked pretty good, pretty healthy, and not a large bear. So it was probably a female, and maybe, you know, could have been a two-year-old, and was picking one of the cylindrical feeders off and holding it in its claws like it was a reticule. It was the funniest thing. And then the bear just walked off with this in its claw, and I called it, and I said, "You bad bear, you dropped that," glanced back at me, and just hustled into the woods. Well, obviously I learned my lesson. I don't know how many feeders I've lost to them, and that's okay. It's worth it. So, yes, they're around, and one must, for their sake, really, more than ours, because if a bear gets used to feeders, they become a nuisance bear. If a bear becomes a nuisance bear, it gets used to people. If it gets used to people, you know, it always ends badly for our beloved wild animals, you know, if they get too cozy with people. Even though it's so tempting to do that, one has to try to... My heart gets broken all the time. And you just have to remember that everything here is about the cycle of life and about, you know, eat or be eaten. And so it's not really a Disney movie. But I'll tell you what is a Disney movie. Speaking of the meadow, on Friday, every time I look out, there's something going on here because I'm so in the middle of everything. I looked out and I saw coming out of the front meadow the beautiful doe was actually standing on the edge. And then I looked again, and right behind her was a newborn fawn. And I know we have too many deer. I know this. I know that. It is this always so incredibly thrilling to see a newborn fawn. Clearly the baby had just been born, because not only was it wobbly, but mama was licking its bum, which the doe has to do to stimulate urination and defecation. And sometimes people find a newborn fawn and don't understand. If that hasn't been done, the animal will not function and can get all kinds of, and will not live. So mama was licking the baby to stimulate all those necessary functions. And then she kind of stepped out into the mown grass, which is between the house and the meadow, and the little one following her, very wobbly. Now, that was Friday. I looked out the back yesterday, and I saw mom again. But what I saw, it's just a matter of 3 days, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, 3 days. I saw the little fawn running, jumping, bucking, and zooming. I would call it zooming. Young animal is great. It just lifts your heart with such joy to see this critter delighting in life and you know, checking out the wonderful legs and the speed and going back and forth. And mom stood there like all good moms do, very patient, letting the little one do his thing or her thing. You know, I can't tell at this point. Darling little thing of spots. And then, of course, Mom just waited and then turned and headed up toward the bomb, and the little one went flying after. But that's just a matter of 3 days, this little shaky leg guy. And that's also the Meadows that I have had this before. You know, she clearly had had the baby in the meadow where it's kind of safe. And if you look closely at that meadow, you'll see whorls in the meadow, like great, you know, whorls of grass matted down. And the deer will bed down there because they kind of feel safe, you know. So that was another wonder. And I also, you know, I don't know if you've seen it, you know, for a while, you know, I have fox, obviously, here. I have gray fox and red fox this year. And I usually don't see bunnies, eastern cottontails, because that's the number one food chain item for a lot of creatures. 80% of those little things are gone at the end of the season because they've been eaten. And but I've had all these bunnies this year, and I've seen them in a lot of places. And again, I was looking out, and I saw several bunnies, single file, coming out of the grass and dispersing. You know, the bunnies are hanging out in there as well. And also, I've just seen my first turkey poults, mama emerging from the grass, followed by turkey babies, which are called poults. And, you know, she may have 10 to 12, and then it's kind of sad because as you watch, you know, every day one or two is gone because of predation. And then the mothers will join together with the remaining poults because there's strength in numbers, certainly more safety and protection. So these meadows become such a place of safe haven and such a place of food source. And I'm having, you know, later we'll have goldenrod, we'll have Joe Pieweed in there, we'll have all kinds of wonderful asters, my favorite wildflower, which is a wonderful native species and beneficial food source. And, you know, now we have these along the edges, these incredible, don't you love wildflower names like yellow bird's foot trefoil? I mean, it's just such a great name. Those are coming in, and we have purple loco weed, and, you know, looking, you know, we have white bed straw, and of course, calvetch, which is a name that always cracks me up, the purple kind of spiky flower. So they're sort of coming, and the Queen Anne's lace is not far behind. And we do have daisies too, and the Queen Anne's lace is not far behind. But it's an incredible ecosystem in itself, aside from the sheer beauty and elegance of it. And then as the season wears on, my lovely grasses, you know, will become bronze. And you have that fall coloration in the meadows, not just our trees, but in the meadows. So I strongly suggest if anyone's listening that has a little patch they'd like to turn into a meadow or a mini meadow, it's wonderfully worth it. You will get so many butterflies and bees, and you'll get little critters too that like to hang out.
I don't understand how you get anything done, because it sounds like you could probably just sit on the porch or inside and look out the window all day.
Don't get anything. Well, I'm only kidding. I do get stuff done, but, you know, I think it was who was it? Was it Burroughs who said this? You know, that people sometimes criticize naturalists as lazy because all we're doing is, you know, wandering around and looking all of the time. But a naturalist is, it's just someone who's looking all the time.
Sure.
I mean, then, of course, it's professionalized and you go to school, blah, blah, blah. But originally, people like Burroughs and Thoreau, I think it was actually Thoreau who said this. It would be Thoreau, you know, who said, no, people sort of say we're lazy, you know, and blah, blah, blah. But that we're doing the most important work of all. We're looking and listening and watching. We're observing.
Well, I mean, that's, and, you know, for me, that's one of the highlights of The Quarry Fox, your wonderful book, because that really it taught me to slow down a bit and to just settle and watch and look. But you just mentioned Burroughs, and I wanted you to get a chance to talk about this upcoming program you're doing. I'll have links
right
on the site, but it's coming up July 6th at 1 p.m. in Roxbury.
Right, at 1 o'clock at John Burroughs Woodchuck Lodge. And that Woodchuck Lodge was actually John Burroughs, who was really arguably the first nature personal essayist as opposed to Thoreau, who was maybe the first nature essayist, a little bit of a difference. But Burroughs, of course, chronicled nature here, and he was a huge celebrity in the 19th century, one of those funny things where people can be not forgotten, but sort of pushed aside a little bit. But his Woodchuck Lodge is preserved. He built it, and it's preserved, and it's quite lovely. And you can sort of sit on the porch, and, you know, every Saturday from, I guess, May through to October, we have a Wild Saturday series. So I'm just going to do this one on animal adaptations, which are such fun, in which I will talk about things like, you know, the milkweed and the monarch butterfly and that unique relationship and how they are interdependent. And we have, you know, quite a few things like that between the animal, you know, and the plant world. And hopefully people will also bring their own stories to share. You know, everything is an adaptation here. You know, you're speaking of the bears. Of course, hibernation is a huge adaptation and one that I think we'd all like to have. And then talk about even things like coloration. Our black bear originally were black because it was a cold weather climb and they needed to absorb the sun. If you go west to other climes, the black bear has a brown morph because it's not as cold and they don't need to absorb so much sun. So much about every creature, including us, has an element of adaptation. And that's what we're going to talk about. It's just an hour. It's free, everybody. And it's a lot of fun. And it's actually right near the original Burroughs homestead. And if you go up the road a bit, and I advise you to Google how to get there, because it can be, it's not tricky, but if you haven't been there, you will get to this little cut in the road that leads to John Burroughs' boyhood rock, which is what he played on as a child. That was his favorite view. And then that view had a lot more farms. You know, there has been a reforestation in the Catskills, our part of the Catskills. And used to play, and he's actually buried there. His grave is there. Just a simple plot lined with stone, and on Boyhood Rock there's a plaque commemorating him, and that's just what Burroughs wanted. He wanted to be, you know, in his native Catskills, in that rocky earth, you know, that we love and are so thwarted by all the time. So it should be a lot of fun. It's always a lively and great crowd, and the people who come are very knowledgeable, and lots of kids come. I always encourage kids to come because they're the best audience, I think, always.
So I'll make sure there's a link in the show notes, but also that, again, it's Saturday, July 6th at 1 p.m. in Roxbury.
Yeah.
And I am going to try to be there, but I'll keep promoting.
Oh,
that as well.
That'd be so great to have you there.
So it's going to be hot today and all this week, and we just have a little bit of time left, but you and I have talked about this in the past, and I think it's really important for people to understand that they've got to stay cool and stay indoors and in the shade as much as they can.
Right.
But so do animals, and there are things that we can do to help. And so you've shared, and I think I've shared some of your advice on the show before, but I'm wondering if you could just take a minute or two to tell people what they could do today to help out the critters.
Well, water is a number one. People forget that. And now it is true, you know, some birds especially get water from insects, and maybe the tree swallows won't come to your water, but every other bird will. And it's not only to drink, but feather health for birds is everything. And they constantly need to keep their feathers clean, because that also makes them use less energy. when they fly. So that's the, it's not just let me take a nice bird bath and cool off, which it is, but it's, again, a complex. So if you have a bird bath, you know, please fill it with water and, you know, check it every day. I hate to say it, my beloved mourning doves love to sit in it and use it as a latrine. I get so annoyed at them. So I'm constantly, I have to go out now and dump it and refill it. And also I put down a little pan of water for my little red squirrels, chipmunks, even those naughty gray squirrels are welcome as far as I'm concerned. So I think water, you know, is incredibly important. And, you know, the old saying, only, what is it, mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun? Well, if you look, animals do not go out in the midday sun. They're not dopey. And everybody, please take this seriously. Years ago, I had the great pleasure and privilege of rafting the entire length of the Colorado through the Grand Canyon. And I really didn't quite get this. And I came very close to heat stroke and having to be helicoptered out, which would have been very embarrassing. Fortunately, I was okay. I had Powerade and it restored the electrolytes, and I kind of learned a very big lesson. You know, no matter how young and healthy you are, and I must have had my hat off like an idiot. And that's another thing, go out, please wear a hat, cover your head. You know, so that can happen to us, and it almost did happen to me. So I really, really, really take it seriously and urge everyone to take it seriously.
Thank you. That's
it's
a real...
serious. And this is...
Yeah, this is hot.
Pardon
and
me?
This is hot. It's going to be really hot, and this is a real public service. I mean, if anybody, like, this is one of the 50 stewards of the Catskills. So you should listen to her. She knows what she's talking about.
Please take it seriously. I almost had to be coptered out of the Grand Canyon. Thank God I didn't have that humiliation in my life.
Well, I want to thank you for spending some time with me today live on the radio, and hopefully later this summer we can get you down to ACRA.
That'd be great.
Be here live.
Thank you, Justin, for being in touch and being my pal, and so many congratulations on Ginger. It is, you know, the newsletter's always been terrific, and your radio show is so fun and original and, you know, quirky and just creative. And
okay.
Thank you for that.
Okay,
that's
okay. I'm blushing, and we're out of time. So anyway,
okay,
Leslie,
right.
Thank you so much. Everybody should go read her book, The Quarry Fox and Other Critters of the Wild Catskills. And
drink water.
Yes, and drink water. And I'm going to let you hang up the phone and go enjoy your meadow. Thank you again, Leslie.
Thank you very much, Justin. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, that was delightful. Every day I get a chance to talk to Leslie is a better day. She sends me all sorts of wonderful emails packed full of information and compliments, and that's a pretty perfect friend. So I want to get us out with some more Keith Jarrett. So let's check that out, and then I'll be back in one moment.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Ginger Radio Hour, live here in the Acra studio of WGXC 90.7 FM. Thank you for listening. Thank you to Leslie T. Sharp. And to Keith Jarrett. And to my wonderful wife, N, who gifted me this album I played today, the other Keith Jarrett album. Stay cool out there, and keep listening to 90.